Good afternoon, everyone. It's Warren Olson. I'm here in our conference room at First Western with my several of my colleagues. You know, with all the recent market volatility and economic news, you know, I thought it might be helpful to do another update call on how First Western's viewing the state of the financial markets and the economy. You know, I always appreciate how busy all of you are, so I'm going to try to make this as productive as possible, although I am beginning to feel a little bit like have volatility will chatter. So we'll see how this goes. Similar to some of my other calls, I thought I'd focus on the following. I do kind of a brief recap of what's been going on in the markets lately. What we're seeing for the global economy going forward for the next several quarters, and we're going to focus really on this call primarily on Europe and the United States because that's where kind of the action's been. Our view of the financial markets going forward. And then finally, I wanted to talk about some historical context. So, you know, in the year to date, it's kind of interesting because if you just looked at the beginning of the year and you sort of skipped everything that had happened to date, you'd actually say that, you know, we've had kind of a, you know, benign or boring year. I mean, the U.S. equity market, you know, if you measure it by the Dow is essentially flat. You know, it's down about 2.5% as measured by the S&P 500, which isn't bad considering we had two really strong calendar years, you know, prior to this. You know, equity in the rest of the world has been a little bit tougher. The world index, forgetting about the United States, you know, is down about 13.5%. And so when you put all that together, you know, the world's equity markets are about, 10% down. But then when you look at the bond market, and if you measure that by the Barclays Aggregate Index, that's the old Lehman Aggregate Index before Lehman met its demise, you know, that's up about 6%. You know, and you see U.S. Treasuries up 7%, corporates and mortgages up about 5% to date. You know, the high-yield market's been flat. Munis are up actually pretty strong, about 8%. You know, commodities are down a little less than 9%. Again, commodities have some pretty big dispersion. So, you know, oil is down about 5%, and then gold, which is really the big outlier of commodities, is up about 20%. You know, if I was doing this call on July 1st, we'd have a pretty different story, because if you looked at the equity market there and you looked at the sort of the four previous quarters, the world's equity markets were up about 30% then. And so, you know, and then, you know, the view of the world's economy was, you know, much more benign. I think my colleague Barry Julian, who works in our Century City office and runs our core fixed income business, who in retrospect was really correct, you know, he would refer to that as kind of overly complacent. And then the third quarter hit, and, you know, as you all know, we saw, you know, huge volatility as investors really switched their focus from kind of fundamental micro concerns or what was going on with, you know, specific companies or stocks or bonds to really macro risks. And there in the third quarter, we had two big risks. Europe, and I'll call that the contagion risk. And then in the United States, and I'll call that the OMG, are we really this stupid risk? The fact that I know what OMG means just means that I have a 20-year-old daughter, by the way. I'm really not that hip, or I don't think I've ever texted OMG. So in terms of these macro risks, you know, what are these? So, you know, Europe, as you know, is basically the contagion risk, or it's kind of the, you've seen this movie before and not too long ago, you're just too stupid to remember the ending. And the people who are, you know, buying into this lay it out like this. So, you know, Greece, followed by Portugal, followed by Italy, followed by Ireland, followed by Spain, default on their government debt. The holders of the government debt, you know, which are primarily European banks, really French banks, are now really undercapitalized, think insolvent, including some surprises in the United States and sort of. In the third quarter, we saw Morgan Stanley, for example, their stock got hit very big time on the idea that they may have big European exposure. So the banks all become insolvent, and then we have kind of this major liquidity freeze like we saw in 2008. And, you know, the system freezes up, everybody's worried about counterparty risk, nobody wants to lend to each other, and so, you know, everything sort of goes badly. And during the third quarter, this got to be, and I wouldn't say consensus, but it got to be felt like this was a really real risk and then could happen. And then in the United States, the OMG, are we really the stupid risk, what happened was, what we did is we took a mechanical non-event, which was the raising of the debt ceiling, which had nothing to do with what we're going to spend in the future. Basically, just made sure that we could sort of pay our bills for what we had already spent or committed to spend. And, you know, the Congress had raised the debt ceiling, I don't know, more than 30 times before. And then we created an artificial crisis. And so what we did is we, you know, scared people into thinking that we might be willing to default on our bond obligations. Nobody thought we didn't have the money to pay. They just thought maybe we had a government that wouldn't pay. And then then what happened during that fight, you know, we created a vitriolic environment so that no one believed the parties were willing to work together to solve things. That hastened, I don't think it caused, but it hastened the downgrading, you know, of our debt with that behavior. In the process, we've managed to, you know, scare the American consumer so that they might stop spending. You know, we had the President of the United States talking about maybe not sending out Social Security checks. And none of the parties failed to put forth sort of a credible, you know, plan to solve any of this. And so between those two items, you know, the financial markets got very scared. We saw a, you know, really difficult environment in the third quarter to be an investor. And it was really characterized by, you know, people talked about risk on, risk off. And so depending on the day, everybody wanted to basically flee out of any asset that they're viewed as having risk. Or if you thought the news was better, you went back into it. Another way to think about it was either that they were sort of, instead of risk on, risk off, sort of contagion on, contagion off. Or the other way to think about it was growth on, growth off. So if things were really bad, there wasn't going to be any economic growth, again, because you were going to see this big seize up in the European community, and the United States was going to go into this recession because everybody was so scared. So what happened in a period like this, you know, we saw the equity market get taken down almost 20%. Fundamentals stopped really mattering, they ceased to matter, and assets kind of behaved as a class. And so for those of you who, you know, watch the markets on TV, we had, you know, green days where the markets were up, but more red days when the markets were down. And what I mean by green or red is they'll post the S&P 500, and every one of the 500 stocks gets a little, a little block. And basically you would have days where, you know, almost all 500 stocks were down in a single day. And if you think about stocks actually representing companies as opposed to just being stocks, it's kind of hard to imagine that on a single day 500 companies all had bad news, especially when some of them compete against each other. So theoretically, some of their bad news should be good news for someone else. Or you saw, you know, 500 green days. That's kind of referred to as, you know, increased correlation among assets. And then we saw, you know, really weird behavior in kind of risk-off assets. So when the U.S. Treasury market got downgraded, and normally when a bond gets downgraded, you think that the value of the bond goes down because you've got a theoretical, you know, expert telling you that there's more risk of getting paid back. We actually saw a huge rally in there because the view was, well, if the bonds are getting downgraded, the economy is getting softer, that makes things scarier. Where do you go when it's scary? Oh, we still go to U.S. Treasuries because even though they got downgraded, we still believe they can get paid back. And then we had gold, which is sort of this outlier, which is this kind of, oh, we can't trust anything asset, you know, that complete safety asset, you know, just sort of go through the roof. So, you know, significant volatility, and you also saw a market where people who tended to be fundamental investors and believe in sort of fundamental values, guys like Bill Gross at PIMCO, the famous bond guy, do, you know, absolutely terrible, maybe the worst quarter of his career. Guys like John Paulson, the famous hedge fund guy who made all the money in the subprime crisis and is the one, I think, getting picketed by the Occupy Wall Street people, just have probably the worst quarter in his career. again, a very difficult environment to be an investor if you looked at fundamentals. Subsequent to the quarter end, as you know, things have calmed down a little bit, and so we've seen the equity market come back. We've seen treasuries back off a little bit. Gold has backed off, and volatility, while still high, isn't quite as crazy. And I think there it's because instead of this sort of doomsday scenario where you see contagion in Europe and the U.S. market falling off the cliff, I think people have stepped back and said, well, maybe it's there's still lots of problems out there, but maybe it's not quite as bad as we see. And so in Europe, I think what's going on there is that it looks like the European Union is probably going to get a handle on the Greek solution and probably the rest of the Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, which they call the pigs. This Sunday is a big meeting, Mrs. Merkel, who's the head of the German government, is trying to talk down expectations that they're actually going to have a full solution there. But it looks like what's happening is they're coming to what I called kind of a shared pain solution. In the beginning, when you have a problem like this, the idea is that you're going to have some big loser. And so initially everybody's like, well, the Greeks have to be the big losers in this because they were completely profligate. They lied about their spending. They didn't have a realistic budget. They don't have realistic work rules. Half of their people work for the government, et cetera. And, we really need to make sure that they pay for this. The problem is the Greeks by themselves can't, shoulder all of the burden on this because, this is a society where you look at people and, whatever you think of it on a macro standpoint, if you're a 40 or 50 or 60 year old Greek, you've basically just been playing by the rules. You've done what you're supposed to do. So you have a government job, you've shown up, and now it's time for your pension. And you're like, wait, you just can't change the rules on us. And you can't impose enough austerity to actually work without having basically social unrest. And so they're sort of at the margin on that. And, and today they had, some more riots there. We saw them, earlier in the summer. But people are understanding that you basically just can't kill that economy by, by saying, okay, everybody takes a 60% pay cut and we're going to stop providing social services, et cetera. You got to make sure that there's austerity there and they have a, something reasonable going forward. And then on the bondholders who lent them the money, you can't the trouble is you can't completely wipe them out because it's too dangerous to the system, but you can't let them completely win either because there's some moral hazard there. So, so the question is how much pain do the bondholders take? And, and that's interesting because that's basically unlike a lot of other, when you own a business bond and there's only so much money there, that's a negotiated solution. European Union's the largest economy in the world as an aggregate, slightly larger than the U.S. And so they have a lot of resources. So it's basically, how do they get this balance compromise? So it's, it's tough to price these bonds, but they're not really complicated bonds either. So it's, how much pain do you make the bondholders take? And then how do you put it in a form that doesn't look like default, which is kind of silly because it's a form over substance thing. But anyway, and then what you have to do, and which is where the European Union comes back in, is you have to be able to make sure that the bondholders can survive the pain. And since most of the bondholders are banks, and most of them are European banks, you have to make sure that they have enough capital to withstand those losses on the haircuts on their bonds. And that's where the European Union is going to step in, similar to sort of TARP back in the U.S. in 2008, and add some capitalization to the banks And the European Union is talking about a big number now. I think the latest number I saw was $2.7 trillion to add to that. But they have, you know, they have the wherewithal. Again, it, you know, it's going to make for a, you know, slow economy. When, you know, we think Europe's probably in a, you know, if not in a technical recession for the rest of, you know, the year and maybe the first half of 2012, pretty close to that. Again, but it's a balanced solution. I think at the end of the day, longer term, European Union, there's more European Union, not less. And what I mean by that is instead of just a monetary union, you've got to have more coordinated budgets and things like that. And I think people are realizing that. I don't think contagion is a huge risk, though. Again, the fact that we had contagion and it already happened in 2008 makes it less likely, not more likely. I mean, everybody likes to jump up and say, hey, yeah, I've seen this picture, but actually it's less likely to happen. There's less leverage in the banking system than there was. You know, I was listening to some, to this guy, Jim Gorman, who's the CEO of Morgan Stanley. And Morgan Stanley, for example, again, not a European Union bank, but a bank with some European exposure, you know, their leverage is 13 times. In 2008, it was 40 times and much higher at a variety of times. There's also less reliance on short-term funding, which is really where you have a problem in something like that, more liquidity. And then interestingly also, again, as I mentioned, the bonds that are the problem, the government bonds, whether they're Greek bonds or Italian bonds, are not really complex instruments. They're hard to price because you don't, because it's a negotiated settlement. But back in 2008 with all the subprime and the asset-backed stuff, this was very complex, and people didn't understand the tranches and the underlying collateral. And so what happened basically is anybody who has any of this stuff, we're basically saying it's not worth anything for a while, and we don't want to deal with you. Here it's a much more transparent solution. So, you know, we think that the European Union gets through on this. And, you know, the U.S. economy, again, people have stopped talking about, you know, recession, that like it's, you know, it's an absolute certainty, but the news is kind of a mixed bag, and we continue to look for, you know, slow growth. At the beginning of the year, we talked about 2.5% growth, and, you know, probably won't get there, but, you know, we'll probably see, you know, 1.5%, maybe 2% growth for the year. I mean, the thing that's really dominating the economic news in the U.S. is unemployment. And that's not surprising. I mean, unemployment's, you know, still above 9%. To put that in context of real people, that's, you know, it's 14 million people.
Kind of underemployment, which is a combination of people who are, you know, working at less than their capacity and people who don't count as unemployed because they've kind of given up.
You know, that's still above 16%. The technical way they measure that is something called the U6. Long-term unemployed, and those are those people jobless for more than half the year, you know, 27 weeks. That's about 44% of the unemployed. That's about 6.2 million people. You know, huge political issue. It's going to be the focus of the presidential election. Clearly, it's big concern for the Fed. You know, their two big concerns are always inflation and employment. But just to give some context, you need about 3% real GDP growth to affect unemployment, in other words, to bring it down. And the reason that you need 3% as opposed to just zero, you know, you'd think if you had any growth, it would bring unemployment down. But you tend to see sort of structural 2% gains in productivity every year, you know, technology, people working smarter, et cetera. And then you see about a 1% in terms of, you need about 1% for increases in workforce. So you can have, you know, you can be in a kind of a slow growth environment, but not be in a recession and not have the liftoff to, you know, to take care of reducing employment. And, you know, I think we're seeing kind of, you know, two broad things keeping unemployment high. The first, everybody's talking about a lot. And the second, though, I don't think people are really focused on. You know, and the first is, you know, businesses continue to be nervous about both the economic and the political environment in terms of wanting to make big commitments to spending, which are generally in our economy commitments to hiring, you know, and that's, you know, again, that's the political system and the unwillingness of the parties apparently to come to the table, you know, concern over whether we are going to see taxes increase or decrease or what happens, you know, rules increasing, you know, that's, you're seeing that primarily in the financial services sector, but things like that. And then this kind of, you know, social unrest thing makes people nervous about hiring. The second thing, though, and the thing that I don't think is getting talked about a lot is, you know, I think we have a little bit of a structural problem with the United States workforce and kind of their fit as to where jobs are coming from. And, you know, I think I've talked about in other calls that the, you know, the great thing about the United States economy, you know, both in the past and I think in the present and continuing, is that it's, you know, it's a really dynamic economy. It's very entrepreneurial, and you don't know where jobs are going to get created. And so, you know, I think we've talked about the fact that, you know, when a contemporary of mine, you know, was Bill Gates, you know, who dropped out of Harvard, created all this wealth, but created, you know, thousands of great jobs. You know, today you got a guy like Mark Zuckerberg, and who would have thought, you know, anybody of my generation would have thought that you could make, you know, basically kind of revolutionize communication with something called Facebook and create all these jobs. So you just never know where jobs are going to come from. I think, though, you know, we've got a problem with our workforce, though, that they're not well situated for that. And so if you look at, you know, if you look at some of the numbers, for example, if you look at the education of the United States workforce, and you know, Kofi helped me with some of this, you know, 30% of our population have a bachelor's degree or higher. So, you know, just keep that in mind. Okay. Another 21% of the population graduated from high school, has some college. 28% of our population only has a high school diploma. 13% of our working population has not graduated from high school. So when you roll back and you look at that and you dissect the unemployment rate for the country, if you look at people who have a bachelor's degree or higher, the unemployment rate's only 4%. If you look at people who have, you know, high school and no college, it's 10%. And then if you look at people who have less than a high school diploma, it's 14%. You know, another way to look at it is, you know, for the population that's 20 years and older, again, unemployment's still much too high, but at kind of 8.4%. But if you look at the 16 to 19-year-old population, you know, again, you know, I'm looking at my colleagues around the table. These are all people who, when they were 16 to 19 years old, were all in, you know, high school or beginning college. You know, that's a 25% unemployment rate. And so we have, you know, a significant amount of the population who's not sort of trained or has the ability to take a lot of these new jobs. And that's not just a, you know, fundamental economic problem. And you see a lot of anecdotal evidence like that. I mean, we see it in our own business in terms of certain positions where it's hard to find the right people to hire. I was down picking up something from Nordstrom's the other day and badgering the poor saleswoman who was helping me. And so I was asking her, you know, are you busy? What's the, you know, what are things like? And she was like, yeah, you know. And again, this is all just anecdotal. And then to just show you how pushy I am, I asked her how much money she makes. And she told me that, you know, they make a combination of an hourly rate and then a commission, and, you know, and kind of averages 17 to 20 bucks an hour. So that's a pretty good job. And then I said, well, you probably just have a problem because you can't get enough hours, right, to work. And she said, no, interestingly, because she was a college student, she's probably in her mid-20s, said, no, we're 40 people shy at this Nordstrom's because we can't find people who come in and can get through the screening criteria that they have, you know, people who are presentable, friendly, et cetera, et cetera. And you see that in a whole variety of things. You know, you see it most in the technology space, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks looking for people to do that. But we have this structural mismatch. And so between, you know, businesses being nervous and this, you know, we could see unemployment stay high for a fairly long time, continue to be a big political issue, a big societal issue, but to be actually less and less of an economic issue for us, interestingly. And again, remember, the trick is not to create jobs. It's to create productive jobs. So the risk to the economy is that you solve the societal and political issue by creating non-productive jobs. And I think I've talked about that before. That's really kind of where the, you know, the Japanese fell down. So, you know, the rest of the economic news, though, in the U.S., is, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag. I mean, you know, if you look at consumer spending, again, you know, everybody always sees that, you know, the consumer accounts for 70% of the economy. You know, I'd characterize that by and by as a net positive, but really fragile. Not surprisingly, given all the things I mentioned before, consumer sentiment hit a 30-year low in the third quarter. And again, if your government nearly defaulted on its obligations, your president and the Speaker of the House were having almost personal spats. You know, the stock market was down 20%. You see these problems in Europe, continued very high unemployment. It's not surprising that sentiment was so low. However, and you see that in a lot of periods, consumer activity, including retail sales, actually wasn't that bad. And so people are like, yeah, I feel really lousy, but they're telling you that while they're in the store buying a TV. And, you know, the latest round that we saw were back-to-school sales, and back-to-school sales were actually pretty okay. You know, we'll see how Christmas sales come out. But, you know, by and by, I would say, you know, consumer spending, net positive, still fragile, but, you know, we're not seeing it in terms of a recession. Longer term, we're actually seeing some pretty good things with consumers as we all kind of as a group continue to repair our balance sheets. So you're seeing increased savings rates, steep drop in household debt ratio, declining mortgage default rates, things like that. So, and longer term, those bode pretty well for things. Manufacturing, again, by and by, pretty okay. You know, there's something called this ISM index, and basically if it stays at 50 and above, it's better than a recession. Below 50, it's worse. And it came down, but it stayed above 50%. The other thing we've seen there is we just haven't seen excess inventory build up. And so that's a pretty good sign that we're probably not going into recession. And then housing is really crummy, but it's getting better. And so, you know, if you looked at house prices, and again, nothing to do with anybody in this room or on the calls, individual house price, but peak to trough, which was kind of July 2006 to February of this year, housing dropped by about a third. I mean, you know, big decimation of the market. But it looks like it's kind of hit a bottom. And so, you know, if you looked at July 06 to August, which is the latest numbers I've seen, they firmed up about a little bit, and they're down, you know, 27-28%. You know, we've seen foreclosures decline marginally. You have to look at it as a year-over-year basis because there's a lot of kind of noise in the month-to-month things. And for me, probably the most important thing is affordability has finally gotten back into levels in kind of the early 70s, better. And that's a combination of, A, the fact that prices are now a third less, or, you know, 30% or so less, and that we have very low mortgage rates. Again, there's some accessibility interest issues because banks are being much tougher in terms of getting mortgages. But by and by, you know, I think that's, again, housing is starting to be a net positive off a low base. And then inflation, you know, we just haven't seen as a big issue yet. I continue to believe at some point the Fed will overshoot and we'll see inflation going forward. But it, you know, it hasn't been a, you know, a big issue for us. So, you know, kind of in a conclusion on the economy, you know, not expecting a global recession, U.S. should muddle along at, you know, 2-ish% growth. Still see high unemployment. That's not enough to significantly reduce employment. Consumer okay, but nervous. Europe probably gets the, you know, the Greek and other government debt problems fixed. It's a compromise solution. Everybody takes a little pain. I haven't talked about China and the other emerging markets yet, which are really the growth markets here. I think China, because of what's happening in the U.S. and Europe, their growth slows a little bit. But there you're talking about, you know, growth from sort of slowing from kind of 9 to 7%. So it's still, you know, really high growth, even with kind of China's population and everything. And I think the Chinese government is probably happy with that. I mean, I think they could torque that up in terms of consumer demand, but they were worried about, things kind of overheating there. So they're probably, in a weird way, sort of happy to see that come down. And I think the other emerging markets are kind of a variation on the China theme. So, you know, higher growth maybe coming off by, you know, a percent or two. So nothing terrible. So kind of where does that leave us on financial markets? Again, I tend to be, you know, remain really bullish on global multinational companies. And the reasons, continue to be kind of the same. I said we have a reasonable, maybe slight, you know, maybe at the margin, you know, slightly deteriorating economic backdrop, but not horrible by any stretch, and probably better than more people are viewing it. These companies, you know, with really low interest rates have access to large amounts of capital, no real wage inflationary pressures. I think continued strong earnings growth. Again, you know, you're seeing the analysts talk those down a little bit with what's going on in the global environment. But if they're not strong, they're at least solid. And then we're seeing really reasonable to cheap valuations. For the S&P 500, we look at something called the price-to-earnings growth ratios. And, people call them the PEG ratios. Whenever they get down around 1%, that tends to be very, very attractive. And the market's about like 1.02%, I think. Our large cap core portfolio that Karen Post runs, it's 0.98, so it's below 1. In the past, that's always been a really good indicator that you're going to see good performance. Again, you know, if you don't believe the earnings growth, then maybe it's at 1.1 or so, which is still pretty historically cheap. And then, you know, the other thing you have to remember is on the S&P 500, you're getting a dividend yield equal to the 10-year Treasury. So on a, you know, comparative basis, it looks pretty good. And then the final thing is, you know, the amount of volatility that we seen in this in the equity market makes them a very painful asset to hold. That tends to make the returns more attractive, the harder it is to hold on to an asset. Bonds, you know, I continue to believe the U.S. Treasuries are overvalued at, you know, essentially 2% for 10 years and 3% for the long bond. Not very attractive. But as you move up the risk scale, you know, munis, pretty reasonably valued, continuing. And then the one thing we have been looking at here are high-yield bonds are looking very attractive. Spreads have really widened. And similar to equities. People's kind of scared of them a little bit with this idea of, you know, what happens if you have, this, you know, horrible economic environment. You know, traditionally, companies that have high-yield bonds tend to suffer. But there, you're really getting paid for the risk. So the high-yield index, the yield's about 9.5%. Default rates have been running at 1%. And, you know, even if those aren't sustainable and they move up pretty substantially, you get good returns there. Just to go through the other asset classes, you know, and there's really six broad asset classes that you can invest in. Cash, this is the type of environment where you have to be, you should always be very conservative with how you invest your cash. Cash is cash for a reason, so you can get your hands on it. And so basically in this environment, you know, you got to take your lumps and you're getting essentially a 0% return. And anybody who promises you a much higher return than that, it's either not cash or there's a lot of embedded risk there. Commodities, you know, we continue to believe that long-term global growth, you know, will push agricultural, industrial metals, and energy commodities higher. Lots of volatility in those asset classes, but they're good long-term asset classes. Private equity, basically the same reasons bullish for the same reasons we are in public equities. Good valuations. Again, those, though, tend to be much more manager-specific. And then the last asset class is absolute return strategies or hedge funds. And, you know, interestingly, this has been a really difficult environment for hedge fund managers. You know, despite the fact that hedge fund managers get this sort of gunslinger approach and they make these big macro bets and do all these things, most really good hedge fund managers tend to be very fundamental investors. And so what they do is that, you know, they're trying to look at, you know, stocks that they think at the margin are better than other stocks that they think are worse, and then they'll go long the stocks that are better and short the ones that are worse. Well, as I mentioned, in the third quarter, because of all these macro concerns, everything's sort of been correlating and people have been focused not really on underlying fundamentals but on macros. So, you know, there's always outliers, but the majority of hedge fund managers have really struggled in this environment. The good ones, again, have not blown themselves up, but it's been really hard to make money here. Continued risks. Europe remains the largest financial risk in the world today. You know, people worried about the sustainability of the EU, this contagion. You know, as I mentioned, I don't think that's likely, but it's a risk that we follow. The United States, again, I think the biggest risk is that we manage to scare ourselves into a recession with either, you know, political rhetoric or what happens in the financial markets. China's always kind of a risk because it's not very transparent, but it seems to be pretty well managed. And then the other, I think, political risk out there is kind of the remnants from the Arab Spring. You know, things just don't happen that quickly, and so we're, you know, you're seeing problems still in Egypt and whether you have another bout over that. You know, it's interesting. When Rebecca asked me to do this call was, you know, a couple of weeks ago when the markets have really, you know, it really sort of felt like they hit bottom. And so I said, well, why don't we wait a couple of weeks? One, because I, not that I'm a great guesser of what happens in the short term, but I thought it was sort of overdone and that things would kind of swing up and maybe people would be a little bit calmer. But the other thing is I wanted to pick this date because October 19th, today is the 24th anniversary for those of you who are old enough around the room or who are financial stock market historians of Black Monday. And, you know, for those of you too young to remember, Black Monday is the you know, worst single day ever in the U.S. stock market. And so on Black Monday, the U.S. market dropped 23% if you measure it by the Dow, you know, sort of 20.5% by the S&P 500. You know, at that time, that was over 500 points in the Dow. I mean, just give you some context there. In 1929, actually what happened is the drop was about the same of 20%, but it happened over 2 days. And then if we look back into 2008, you know, the drops on September 29th and October 15th were 9%, although the points, because of the, you know, the points were higher. And, you know, I was thinking back, I was, you know, I was working in New York then, and thinking back to sort of what had happened during that time and kind of all the, everything that, you know, happened thereafter. And it was really interesting because, the market jumped back a little bit and then it had another kind of aftershock. And then there was this, you know, there were a lot of news about, you know, is equity investing dead? The, I forget whether it was the government, but this, you know, this group of economists convened in early December of 1987 and basically said that this would have long-term repercussions for the U.S. economy. Stocks would never go back to the same levels. You would never see good returns in stocks again. And it would be just like the 1930s. And this was a, you know, pretty well, you know, respected group of economists in December of 87. Well, by about June 1988, the market had fully recovered. It was kind of a blip on the, you know, it was a blip on the economy. And if you had invested at that time in 1987 in the stock market and just stayed invested today, you would have made about 7.5 times your money. So for every, you know, a dollar, you'd have $7.50. And just to show you that you don't need, you know, outsized returns to do that, the, you know, the power of compounding, that's about an 8.5% annual return. And that's what sort of all the, you know, all the craziness. So, you know, when people are always saying, oh, it's different and, you know, and this, we're always going to see, I think, volatility in financial assets. It's, you know, it's kind of a byproduct of the fact that, you know, you get it priced daily, and for a lot of these assets, you could sell it daily. So, you know, again, if, you know, if all the, this volatility and the risk and uncertainty is kind of making you crazy and you're wondering what you should do, you know, I've talked about the markets a little bit, but, you know, the other thing I would really suggest that people do is if you don't have a financial plan, and I don't mean an investment plan, I mean sort of a, you know, financial plan about, you know, how do I meet my obligations? What's my spending look like? Do I know what my balance sheet is? You know, it's not that difficult to put one in place. And when times are really stressful, you generally see that you're probably better than you think you are, and you're not going to end up, you know, in your closet eating cat food or something. So it you know, kind of reduces stress and keeps you from kind of these emotional responses. Obviously, you know, at First Western, we can help you put one together if you want us to. And then the second, and, you know, something that I tend to talk about a lot is, you know, think about what your real investment risks are. And again, if you think about the three types of risks, you know, what when you're investing, the first is that you can always have what I call permanent impairment of capital. Not that the market goes down 10%, so your GE stock, you know, used to be 100, is now worth 90, and then tomorrow it'll be worth, you know, 105, that you really do lose that money. And so, you know, look through your portfolios and think about, you know, where it's likely that you could lose that money on a permanent basis. And I think for most people who have broadly diversified portfolios, you know, if you look at the underlying stocks, you're going to find that there's not a lot of places that you'll see permanent impairment of capital. The second is to, and which I think is really important, is to make sure you take care of your liquidity risk. With this kind of volatility, you don't want to be forced to be selling assets when it's a bad time to be doing it. So, you know, make sure that you can handle your liquidity for the next, you know, year, 2 years, and what the sources are. You know, for most of us around the table, they actually don't come from our investment portfolio or entirely if you're still working. But if you're not, or you need to subsidize that, think about liquidity, because that's a, you know, that's a huge risk. And then the third is you've got to think about your inflation risk. And although inflation is low now, it's not going to stay low forever. And for a lot of us, the, you know, the biggest things we're going to face are either higher education expenses for our kids or health care. And those are still inflating. But if you think about those, you have a plan that's sensible, you remember some historic context, you think in a global sense, and you think in terms of valuations, it's actually, you know, as tough as it's been, excuse me, it's not a horrible time to be investing. And, that, you know, I think basically that if you have a well-constructed plan, that'll help you stick with it. So with that,
thanks. Thanks, Rebecca, for getting that set up. And,
you know, you can always reach me at wolson@fwtb.com or at 303-531-8102 if you have specific questions. Thank you. Bye-bye.